This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Russia warns the United States that it is risking direct engagement in the war by supplying Ukraine with long-range weapons. China urges the U.S. to stop provoking separatist forces in Taiwan. And Hamas says the Palestinian anti-Israeli operations are a natural response to the regime's occupation and crimes. Hello and welcome. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisum Shahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. Russia once again warns the United States against providing Ukraine with long-range weapons, saying Washington is almost becoming a direct party to the conflict.
We are warning the U.S. against taking provocative steps, such as deliveries of longer-range and more devastating weapons. It's a road to nowhere fraught with grave consequences, the responsibility for which will lie entirely on Washington.
The Russian deputy foreign minister also underlined his country's military doctrine that allows it to use nuclear weapons in case of foreign aggression on an existential threat. He said Moscow would push ahead with its offensive in Ukraine until all of its goals are achieved. The U.S. has sent several batches of heavy weapons to Ukraine. Most recently, it provided Kiev with a high-mobility multiple rocket launchers, or HIMARS, which are significant in the capabilities that they have. The missiles supplied to Kiev have a range of up to 80 kilometers, but the U.S. has expressed its intention to supply those with a range of more than 300 kilometers. Russia has warned the West, and the U.S. in particular, that they are prolonging the war by arming Ukraine. The International Atomic Energy Agency has expressed concern about the physical condition of Ukraine's nuclear power plant due to fighting and shelling in the area.
First is the physical integrity of the facilities. It's because there's still, we have been seeing military activity around the plant, and I was able to see myself and my team impact holes, markings on buildings of shelling. So it means that the physical integrity of the facility has been violated not once, but several times.
Grossi was speaking in Vienna following a visit to the Russian-controlled plant. The IAEA mission surveyed the plant and assessed potential damage to it. Grossi, however, dismissed allegations that his visit was restricted or manipulated. That after the Ukrainian president accused Russia of barring international journalists from entering the facility. The Kremlin has described the IAEA visit as very positive. Russia and Ukraine blame each other for a repeatedly shelling of the plant. Earlier, the Russian defense minister also accused the U.S. and the EU of encouraging reckless actions around the plant by providing Ukraine with weapons. Kiev has admitted bombing what it calls a Russian base in the district where the plant is located. The Group of Seven Developed Countries, or G7, has agreed to impose a price cap on Russian oil imports despite warnings from the Kremlin. Here's the German finance minister with the stated purpose of this move.
We want to limit Russia's revenues and at the same time reduce economic damage to our societies. This price cap on Russian oil exports is designed to reduce Putin's revenues.
Importers seeking shipping services and insurance cover from companies based in G7 and EU countries now need to adhere to a price cap to transport Russian oil. The level of the cap hasn't been decided yet. Meanwhile, hours after the announcement, the Russian energy giant Gazprom extended the shutdown of gas flows to Germany, providing no time frame for the reopening. The company said that it has identified malfunctions on a key turbine along the pipeline which carries natural gas from Western Russia to Germany. It said the pipeline would not restart until repairs were fully implemented. European countries, however, accused Russia of using energy as a political tool to face Western sanctions over the war in Ukraine. And as Italy is crippled with soaring energy costs, its government is discussing the adoption of energy-saving measures for winter. Some EU members have already introduced similar measures in an attempt to reduce gas usage. Max Civilli reports.
On Thursday, Italy's outgoing government discussed an energy-saving plan during a Council of Ministers aimed to save up for this winter as part of efforts to reduce the country's dependency on Russian gas. Ecological Transition Minister Roberto Cingolani's plan includes limiting the use of heating in apartment blocks and public buildings. Italians will be demanded to turn down the central heating by 1 degree and turn it off for an hour at dusk every day starting in October. Italy is struggling with increased energy costs as wholesale gas prices have surged to historic levels across Europe since the start of the conflict in Ukraine.
Italy and a few other countries, including Belgium and the Czech Republic, are among those seeking an EU price cap on gas for power, but some members of the bloc, including France, are against this option. An emergency meeting of European Union energy ministers will be held in Brussels on September 9 to reach a consensus on tackling skyrocketing power costs.
We have a big gas problem. Our families and businesses are struggling, and politicians keep talking about making more debt to alleviate the crisis. But that would just be a patchwork. Italy must leave the TTF, the virtual trading point for natural gas based in the Netherlands, and then we can discuss a new LNG strategy.
Meanwhile, the Italian Confederation of Enterprises, Confcommercio, has warned some 120,000 Italian service sector firms could go out of business over the next 10 months.
I costi dell'energia sono ormai la vera emergenza.
The rise of energy costs is the real emergency. Service sector firms will spend a total of 33 billion euros on energy bills, 3 times as much as in 2021. The government must speed up the procedures to access the funds of the EU Energy Recovery Fund and to make sure that the price cap on gas for power is adopted.
If energy costs keep rising at the current pace, Confcommercio, which has estimated that 370,000 jobs are at risk, is calling on the government to extend tax relief and to mandate that bills can be paid in smaller installments. The bad news for Italy doesn't stop there. Inflation jumped to 9% in August from 8.4% the month before. Financial analysts expect inflation to grow further, reaching 10% in October. Max Civilli, Rome.
China issues a stern warning as the U.S. State Department has given the green light to President Joe Biden to supply Taiwan with arms worth over $1 billion. A spokesperson for the Chinese embassy in Washington says the arms delivery would severely jeopardize relations as well as peace and stability across the Taiwan Strait. He warns that Beijing will take legitimate and necessary countermeasures over the move that provokes separatist forces in Taiwan. The Pentagon has announced a military aid package for Taiwan that includes 60 anti-ship and 100 air-to-air missiles. The Biden administration says the package has been under consideration for quite some time. The approval, however, comes amid heightened tensions. The two big economies have been on a collision course ever since the controversial visit by House Speaker Nancy Pelosi to Taiwan last month. Tensions escalated further after more American politicians landed there. Beijing considers Taiwan part of its territory and has repeatedly warned Washington against its growing ties with the island. Independent China specialist Andrew Leung says the U.S. has been emboldening separatist forces in Taiwan to stand against China.
The United States has been using Taiwan as an unsinkable carrier, aircraft carrier, to confront the Beijing government, supplying more and more advanced weapons and training the Taiwan's army, and fueling the idea of separatism without saying so. Of course, the United States openly says that it still abides the one China policy and does not support independence. But in effect, what has been doing is the opposite. But as far as China is concerned, the long game of unification, peaceful unification, has already started. Peaceful doesn't mean to let the situation drift. It's also applying all sorts of pressures to pressurize the Taiwanese government into peaceful negotiations. Of course, if Taiwan should ever formally declare independence, that would trigger immediate military action, because China has long prepared for this scenario with the enactment of the Anti-Succession Act in Beijing decades ago. That translated into deployment of missiles, military forces, fortifying military installations, building up the Chinese Navy. All sorts of things have been prepared for this eventuality. But the preferred policy is still peaceful unification, in spite of the provocations by Washington.
Cuba accuses the United States of pushing its citizens against the government by funding the so-called democracy promotion programs in the island nation.
For the United States, it is not enough to have a policy directed at trying to provoke hunger, malnutrition, and scarcity in Cuba. Besides that, after doing this, they are urging the Cuban people by using $6 million from taxpayers to rise up against the government because of the problems we are facing as a result of the blockade.
The deputy foreign minister called those programs interventionist and illegal. Fernandez has said that Washington has been trying to topple the Cuban government for decades, but has never attempted in such an explicit way before. He said the U.S. punishes its own citizens for working as foreign agents, but encourages such illegal behavior in other countries. In July, the U.S. President Joe Biden announced a program which awards organizations and individuals over $6 million for, quote, promoting democratic change in Cuba. The Caribbean island nation has been under U.S. embargo since 1962. It is now grappling with its worst economic crisis, with acute shortages of fuel and basic goods such as food and medicine. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has praised an anti-Israeli operation in the occupied West Bank city of Al-Khalil. Hamas further expressed condolences to the family of a man who was gunned down by Israeli forces following the operation. The movement also called for more attacks on Israeli troops and settlers. Tel Aviv claims a Palestinian man was not dead after stabbing an Israeli soldier. Meanwhile, scuffles broke out between Israeli troops and Palestinians who were trying to help the wounded man. Regime forces hurled sound grenades and fired tear gas to prevent them from reaching the Palestinian man. The Israeli military has recently stepped up deadly raids across the occupied territories. Political activist Moti Abu Musabe says Palestinians have no choice but to defend themselves against Israeli activities in the wake of international communities' inaction to hold the regime accountable for its crimes.
I think it has become a matter of fact that Israel considers itself as an above-the-law state. Mainly because, and basically because of the impunity given by the international community and by the ongoing and the blind support of the United States administrations that gives the total support for the Israeli occupation without any kind of accountability or without holding the Israeli occupation accountable for committing those crimes and those attacks. Today, the Palestinian people actually is paying the price of that kind of abhorrent silence of the international community. Today, the blood of the Palestinian children and the blood of the Palestinian civilians actually is on the hand of the international community. and the United States administrations. And I think today, and without having any kind of sanctions and any kind of holding the Israeli occupation accountable for its crimes, Israel will keep committing its crimes. Therefore, the Palestinian people have no choice but to resist the Israeli occupation with all means available.
A Palestinian inmate held in an Israeli jail near the occupied West Bank city of Bethlehem has died due to deliberate medical negligence by prison authorities. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has condemned this as a crime and violation of all humanitarian norms and laws. Our correspondent Mona Kandel tells us more.
Musa Abu Mohammed, 40 years old, a Palestinian man from the town of Beit Tamar in Bethlehem, was held by the Israeli forces, and he was arrested several months ago, according to the Israelis, because he was caught in Al-Quds without having Israeli issued permit. It's prohibited and it's banned for Palestinians living in the occupied West Bank to enter the lands occupied in 1948 without Israeli issued permits. Anyways, this Palestinian man was sick, according to his family, and his health condition deteriorated several weeks ago, but he was transferred to hospital Asaf Harafeh 3 days ago, and unfortunately this morning he passed away inside the Israeli hospital. Of course, due to medical negligence, he was sick, his health deteriorated, and the Israelis didn't give him the needed medical medications, or even they didn't transfer him to hospital on time. After 3 days in the Israeli hospital, he passed away.
Russians are paying their last homage to deceased Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev before laying him to rest in Moscow later today. Gorbachev, known in the West as Gorby, died on Tuesday at the age of 91 following a long illness. A long line is formed as people march past the coffin. The funeral will be a low-key affair, as a few foreign leaders are expected to do to the ongoing tensions between the West and Russia. That brings us to the end of this edition of World News.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
In itemizing the contents of boxes seized materials from Trump's Mar-a-Lago home, a detailed inventory of items put together by the U.S. Justice Department showed the FBI retrieved 71 empty folders from Trump's office and 19 empty folders from a storage room when agents executed a search warrant at Mar-a-Lago recently. We now present you an article written by Hugo Lowell. The piece is titled FBI Materials Seized from Trump's Mar-a-Lago Home Included 90 Empty Folders. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. Please stay with us for more of Hugo Lowell's article. According to a detailed inventory of items made public on Friday, 2nd of September, among the items the FBI retrieved from Donald Trump's Mar-a-Lago resort recently were 90 empty folders marked classified or for return to the White House staff secretary or a military aide. The inventory, unsealed by a federal judge overseeing the former president's request to get a so-called special master to determine what materials the Justice Department can use in its investigation, provided the fullest picture to date of what Donald Trump had retained. In itemizing the contents of boxes of seized materials, the inventory put together by the Justice Department showed the FBI retrieved 71 empty folders from Trump's office and 19 empty folders from a storage room when agents executed a search warrant at Mar-a-Lago recently. According to the inventory, the empty folders carried one of two designations. Some files had classified banners, while other files were labeled Return to Staff Secretary, Military Aid, appearing to indicate that highly sensitive documents were not returned as designated. The startling discovery immediately raised for the first time the prospect that some of U.S. government's most closely guarded secrets could remain unaccounted for, even after the FBI went through Mar-a-Lago and retrieved vast amounts of materials from the property. Still, the Office of the Director of National Intelligence is conducting a risk assessment, not a damage assessment, of Trump's unauthorized retention of classified documents, signaling that, at least for now, it believes the material has not otherwise been compromised. The inventory showed U.S. federal agents also seized thousands of government documents, some with classification markings ranging from confidential to top secret, and others that appeared to be presidential records, as well as hundreds of newspaper and magazine clippings from 2008 through to 2020, gifts and clothes. In a status report from its case team conducting the criminal investigation into the Mar-a-Lago documents that accompanied the inventory, the Justice Department said that although it had completed an initial review of the materials, its full review process was ongoing. The statement from the Justice Department read, "The seized materials will continue to be used to further the government's investigation, and the investigative team will continue to use and evaluate the seized materials as it takes further investigative steps, such as through additional witness interviews and grand jury practices." The Justice Department added in the status report that it intended to use all evidence about the documents, including their nature and their location, to inform the criminal investigation examining potential obstruction of justice and potential violations of the Espionage Act. Donald Trump remained quiet about the release of the inventory on Friday, 2nd of September, though a spokesman said it showed the FBI had overreached. The new detailed inventory list only further proves that this unprecedented and unnecessary raid of President Trump's home was a smash and grab. The detailed list of 33 boxes seized from Mar-a-Lago, which followed the release of the initial property receipt filled out by the FBI at the time of the search, additionally provided more information about how sensitive documents were commingled with more general items Donald Trump potentially kept as souvenirs. For example, item number 26, described by the Justice Department as a box or container from storage room, included 8 press clippings from 2017 to 2020, 3 documents marked top secret, an article of clothing, a book, and 1,841 government documents or photographs without classification markings. The chaotic and wide-ranging contents of the boxes reflected previous reporting by The Guardian and others that the West Wing and the White House residence was packed up in a hurry and in haphazard fashion during the final days and final hours of Donald Trump's presidency. According to former aides, Donald Trump was something of a pack rat who hoarded materials he saw as his, and partly as a consequence of his refusal to accept that he'd lost the 2020 election. Many items from the White House were collected into boxes that were transported to his residence at Mar-a-Lago. The Justice Department said the items listed in the inventory have already been screened for potential attorney-client privilege. Judge Eileen Cannon is expected to rule shortly on whether to grant Donald Trump's request to have a special master conduct a filter instead. At least 320 classified documents have been recovered from Mar-a-Lago since January. More than 100 of those were seized in the August search. The Justice Department has also released a photograph of folders marked secret and top secret scattered over a Mar-a-Lago carpet. Some were stamped "No Fawn," indicating they should not be seen by any non-US citizen without permission. Donald Trump has decried the investigation as a politically motivated attack on him, and nearly all top Republicans have closed ranks around him and rallied to his defense. His lawyers have sought to argue that the case should be treated akin to failing to return a late library book, not a real threat or conspiracy. Donald Trump has never explained his motive in retaining these documents, and top Democrats have said his resistance to returning them to the Justice Department, even after being subpoenaed, is evidence of obstruction of justice that the Justice Department should prosecute. The U.S. Democrats have also said the documents reveal a fundamental lawlessness in Donald Trump's behavior, characterized by acting with impunity and a disregard for the U.S. norms and traditions that usually govern former presidents. At the same time, the scandal has probably harmed Donald Trump's frequent hints that he wants to run for the White House again in 2024. Joe Biden has used the FBI search as part of a general warning of the extremist nature of Donald Trump and his followers, which in a primetime speech on Thursday night, 1st of September, he portrayed as a growing threat to American democracy and a potential cause of political violence. Since the FBI raid of Mar-a-Lago, numerous law enforcement officials have warned that federal buildings and government workers are at risk of attack, especially as right-wing politicians and media pundits have sought to blame them for seeking to stop any Trump political comeback.
This one lay.
Doing us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to Spotlight. A report has revealed that Russia and Ukraine were ready for a potential peace deal back in April, but the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson prevented that deal from taking place. Johnson reportedly told Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky that even if Ukraine is ready for peace, Kiev's Western backers are not. Who are Kiev's Western backers exactly, and why are they dictating terms to Kiev? And what if peace had taken place? How many Ukrainian lives would have been saved? And what about European economies? But they've been relieved from the soaring energy bills and the looming energy crisis. These are just some of the questions we'll be asking on tonight's Spotlight. And here are the guests that we have. Activist and commentator Don DeBar joining us from Westchester, New York. And we also have journalist, activist, and political analyst John Bosnich joining us from Belgrade.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. DeBar. According to multiple former U.S. officials, back in April, Russian and Ukrainian negotiators appeared to have agreed on a peace deal, but the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson prevented that deal from taking place. What do you make of this news, and why would peace not be on the agenda of Europe and the U.S.?
Well, let me answer the last question first. You could look at what Adolf Hitler wrote in 1922, was it, I think? His little jail cell tome, My Struggle, looking eastward for the opportunities for empire for Germany, the substitute for 200 years of colonizing the world like Britain and France and Spain had done, was to take Russia. And the resources and the population and the real estate itself were enough for Germany to rule the world, in his opinion. And if you look at the material basis of his argument, basically, it's true. The U.S. has been licking its chops, looking at Russia's mineral wealth, its educated workforce, and its vast real estate, its vast footprint on the planet. It's major share of the Eurasian continent. Since 1917, certainly, but even earlier. They bought Alaska from Russia, by the way, and there were people who had ambitions to buy further to the west of Alaska or into Eastern Asia. In terms of the admission that this has been happening and also the fact that the attempt at making peace was thwarted by Washington and London, it's particularly interesting to see that this is being spoken by Fiona Hill and Angela Stent. Fiona Hill was a member of the Trump administration. That much is being credited to her. But she was actually allied with that portion of the Trump administration that were sort of inserted along with those who helped put the dossier together to try to take Trump out. she spent a few hours, something like 10 hours, I think, in secret testimony during the impeachment, the first impeachment trial. Angela Stent also, the two of them are both hardcore Cold Warriors, and they would love to see Russia's government taken down. And so for them to admit that peace was thwarted in April, when it was possible, between Ukraine and Russia, means that this is not some, you know, Russian propaganda claim. These are people who are actually bragging that it was thwarted, because their aim is actually to make Russia bleed as much as possible and see if they can't force some sort of uprising in the country to take a pipe dream. But that's the dream that Langley has right now, and these two people are totally on board with it.
John Bosnich, Boris Johnson reportedly told Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky that even if Ukraine is ready, Kiev's Western backers are not. Tell us more about who are exactly Kiev's Western backers, and why would they not want a peace agreement at all?
Okay, well, we have to start from the basic premise that we're talking about the Anglo-American empire. And I think we should insert the word war empire, because it's not just that they have a functioning empire of economic production, trade routes, and so on, but the key element of the Anglo-American empire is that it is an empire for the purpose of war. One normally thinks that in history wars were fought to acquire resources, to acquire a strategic position, to control trade routes, and so on. But actually, that has evolved over time to the point where war itself is the purpose of the empire, because the biggest possible profit is not from extracting minerals from the ground. It is not from mining gold. It is not from pumping oil, but it is from the purchase, sale, and trade of weapons. So that is the objective of the empire. The empire is based on war itself. It is war with no other goal other than war itself. And that's why the order was given to Ukraine. Not to protect them strategically, not to protect resources, not to end the war, but to keep the war running for war itself.
Don DeBar, the report said Johnson's position was that of the quote-unquote collective West, which feels Putin is not as strong as they initially thought, and they see the war as an opportunity to press Putin. Taking into account the ripple effects, specifically the energy crisis that Europe is facing, would you say that this was a miscalculation?
Yeah, I think there are miscalculations across the board. There's a term that's used in colloquial American English about believing your own, and I'll use the letter substitutes, BS. It appears that Langley or whoever else is responsible for making policy in Washington has spent much too much time conferring with the propagandists and not enough with the strategists and those taking stock of what goes on in the world in reality. I'd really like to argue with what Mr. Bosch has just said, except I can't find any levers to hang on to argue with it. Certainly, looking at the military budget of the United States alone, let alone Britain, France, et cetera, it is larger than, I believe it's the next 10. And out of that, China has a military budget of about a quarter of that of the U.S. now. It's been forced to scale up. Russia's, the last measurement that I saw comes from the year 2019, was about $65 billion as opposed to the U.S. military budget of between $800 billion and a trillion, and that's on the books. And when one looks at what one buys for that on the ground, it becomes clear that the purpose of these budgets is actually, you know, to mask massive theft. You may have a military state whose only purpose is war, but what drives it, I think, in my opinion, is theft, and that war provides an excellent cover, and it is also, I've used this phrase three times now in the last couple of days, but a perpetual motion machine, almost self-sustaining, where as the budgets scale up for yet another war, more money is transferred into the pockets of some very wealthy people. It requires a militarization of people all around the event. For example, the U.S. military budget growing means that so will Britain's and France's and Germany's and, you know, and everyone else's. And the people that they aim those militaries at, of course, are forced to scale up. And so everybody makes even more money. And as the weapons are captured, destroyed, and just utilized, used up, they have to be replenished. So it is like a self-perpetuating monster. And it can certainly appear that war is its own purpose. In any event, whatever purpose it is serving, it is sustained by war making for sure.
John Bozich, in addition to that, Secretary of Defense of U.S. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin said one of Washington's goals in Ukraine is to see a weakened Russia. Why does Washington want a weak Russia? Unpack Lloyd Austin's comments for us, please.
Well, if Russia is weakened, the ability of the United States to provoke more wars on the Russian borders, not just in Ukraine, but anywhere they can provoke a conflict, in Lithuania, some conflict related to Iran, wherever they can provoke a conflict, it's more business. So we have a really paradoxical situation here where I think your listening audience is going to have trouble grappling with this. When an American weapon or tank or plane is shot down, the loudest cheers are in the United States at the headquarters of the weapons providers, because they can now sell a new tank, a new airplane, a new weapon system to the American government. So it is a perpetual motion machine. The purpose of the machine is war making. And if you can picture this in your minds, if you close your eyes, what you've got is the U.S. taxpayer hooked up to an automatic milking machine. So you've got 300 million U.S. taxpayers who are hooked up to automatic milking machines, which milk them for their money. So the victim of the war is a civilian, and it's the American civilian taxpayer who is being milked 24 hours a day, even when they're sleeping, for their money. That is the paradigm that American citizens live in. And unfortunately, because that's the paradigm of the world we live in, we live in a world full of war, perpetual war.
Don DeBar, as the conflict enters its seventh month, Joe Biden announced nearly $3 billion in U.S. military aid. That support, as stated, will be used for buying and purchasing military equipment for the long term. Does the conflict in Ukraine have the potential of morphing into a war of attrition?
Well, it's already been that. First of all, the numbers that have been discussed recently about aid, quote unquote, to Ukraine, in other words, some of the milking that John refers to, this is someone here that's somewhat dehydrated from having been milked over the last 60-something years. You have a situation where something like $50 to $60 billion in quote unquote aid has been sent to Ukraine since February. Now, no one knows how much of that money actually hit the ground in Kiev, for example, or got dropped off in Swiss bank accounts or whatever. But again, on scale, you know, Russia's military budget of $65 billion is to defend a massive piece of real estate that runs from the Polish border to the Sea of Japan, the Arctic Circle, to China and India, et cetera, and, you know, the Black Sea and all of that. And Ukraine having a war on just that one little front, and they have as much money passing through their hands as the entire annual budget of the Russian military. So the idea is to have Russia certainly suffer a war of attrition of material. I don't know what kind of fatalities they thought they could impose on Russia's military, but Russia has a population of about four or five times that of Ukraine, and more importantly, I think the people of Russia are much more supportive of, you know, this is for them, this is a war of survival. People of Ukraine are divided into half, practically, and so It's a bad idea to conduct a war of attrition because they'll lose. Ask Hitler, ask Napoleon how that worked out.
And John Bozich, Russian foreign minister, in a July interview with the country's state media, said that compromise is no longer an option. These are his words. Even giving Russia all of Donbass is not enough. Now the geography is different. Foreign Minister Lavrov asserted in describing Russia's short-term military aims, that is, it's also Kherson and Zaporizhia regions, as a number of other territories. The goal is not negotiation, but Ukrainian capitulation. So here we see Russia having its own objectives changing now that that window of opportunity for peace has passed.
Indeed, that's the case. But there's a very logical reason for that. Russia entered into this conflict after waiting 8 years through a clear policy of genocide on the part of the Kiev regime against its own ethnic Russian citizens. Russia did something America would have never done, and that was patiently negotiate and attempt to find a peaceful solution. When it was found in April that there was a peaceful solution, then that was scuppered on the side of the Americans. Why? Because the Americans, as we've already said, and my fellow commentator Don DeBar has said, because the Americans are in this for war itself. So then we proceed, and the war has continued since this April attempted peace agreement, and here we are now in September. And suddenly, it's not Russia who's talking about the scuppered agreement, it is America. Which means that America realizes and has leaked this story to the media, because America realizes that now not only are they losing territory, they're losing the entire war that they intended to continue forever, because Russia is winning so quickly and so overwhelmingly that the war that they wanted to have last forever is not going to last as long as they want it. So not only have they lost the territory and the control of Ukraine, they're actually losing the ability to fight war forever. So it's a double loss for America, and therefore America leaks this story to try to put pressure for a quick, peaceful solution. Too late, gentlemen, you missed your chance. It is now a war for strategic control of the territory that America had used and tried to turn into a NATO base to destroy Russia. Russia must stop that objective from ever happening again, and Russia will do so. I fully expect Russia to take control of the entire seacoast of the Black Sea so that the rump Ukraine ends up being a landlocked mini state that has to actually give its own western territory okay. to Poland in order to survive.
Don DeBar, let's turn our attention now to Europe. Massive inflation, a cost of living crisis, an energy crisis. Some countries like the UK having its citizens face unprecedented energy bills, with many European countries facing energy rationing, high oil and gas prices as well. This is all, of course, the fallout of Ukraine conflict. How much is Europe losing in all of this in comparison to the United States? What's the cost of this conflict and its repercussions for Europe as opposed to the U.S.?
Well, you have to distinguish between the elite in Europe and the population, you know, the billion or so people that live in Europe, because there are two different sets of interests there that are being expressed without any, you know, mask at this point. I think you could say that this was articulated out of the mouth of the German foreign minister this past week at the 2000 forum, that she said this is the highest ranking Green Party official in the world. She's the foreign minister of Germany, which is a pretty high office. I asked von Ribbentrop, who held that office under Adolf Hitler. She said, in essence, that things are bad and they're going to get worse for the German people, and that the German people are going to be looking to their politicians for relief. And she said, in essence, I know we've promised that we would make your life better, we're going to do what we can, but we also promised Ukraine we would stand with them, and we intend to do so. And so they are going to double down regardless of the consequences. Now, I thought back when Donald Trump mentioned about NATO being obsolete, that he was taking a look at the fact that there was austerity across Europe for, at that point, about 30 years, and that the tax, essentially, that NATO is on the economies of the European countries was exacerbating the problem, and he saw that as something that needed to be resolved by, on the one hand, taking it off the back of American taxpayers, and the theory was that the Europeans would pick it up. But I think what was really behind it was, in essence, the European populations would not allow that, and NATO would finally be put to bed where it belonged. Those contradictions that exist in those European countries, with the people against their own economy basically being screwed by the elite, have only intensified since 2016, and particularly since February. And so doubling down, in my opinion, is likely to produce not just allow the bubbling unrest already to express itself, but it may actually produce some revolutions in Europe. And I'm not talking hyperbole here. In France, the yellow vests have not demobilized, and now that you're talking about people actually freezing to death this year. That was enough for Paris Commune, 200 years ago. And so we may be looking at the EU dismantling, but more importantly, some sort of unrest that hasn't been seen perhaps since the beginning of the 20th century.
John Bosnich, the U.S. has on many occasions called Iran a destabilizing factor. Iran's foreign minister, who's just visited Russia, presented Moscow with an unnamed European leader's proposal for a peace initiative to end the war. The Iranian foreign minister said their ideas to help establish peace and stop the fighting in Ukraine, and I shared these ideas with Mr. Lavrov. Who's the destabilizing factor now?
Well, it's obviously the Anglo-American war empire, which is the destabilizing factor here, and they're having a little bit of trouble justifying continuing the war to their own populations. So they are presenting the war as Russian aggression, which it is not. It is a Russian response to NATO aggression in Russia's hinterland, directly next to their capital. So the entire, this is what George Orwell in 1984 called black-white. Whatever is white is called black, and whatever is black is called white. They are making the aggressor out of the defender, and they're making the defender into the aggressor. This is a lie which cannot be foisted on the people of Europe, because the people of Europe have some media that are independent of Washington. It can be pushed on the people of America because they don't listen to any media in any other language other than English, and the only other purveyor of the story is England, which is Washington's partner. But the story is running thin, and as the winter comes, Europe is going to be destabilized, and America is now afraid that maybe its European military colony called the EU could fall apart. And there are problems in Hungary, and there are problems in Poland. And that is what America is afraid of, because so long as it can keep the EU together, it can use the EU to force the NATO partners to reimburse America all the money that they've spent. So they not only rob the American taxpayer, they then go to the EU and NATO and ask them to pay America back. It's a double ripoff of their own people and the people of Europe.
All right, thanks a lot, gentlemen. That's all the time we have for tonight's show. Activist and commentator Don DeBar joining us from Westchester, New York, and journalist, activist, and political analyst John Bosnich joining us from Belgrade. Thanks for contributing to the program,
thank
and
you.
Also a special thanks to you for staying with us on tonight's Spotlight.
Thank you too.
It's good night for
tell
now.
John, thank
see you next
too,
time.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Tawakkul comes from the root word wakala. Wakala means...
Today, I'd like to read to you an excerpt from...
Allah is the unique Arabic name.
Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has decreed.
His decree, though...
This is Foresight, a program on how to worship Allah.
Now, dear listeners, we had talked about in a previous program about a concept and an idea which was considered mura'at. And this mura'at we had defined was a considerateness. Now, this mura'at, of course, which we had talked about, is this considerateness and this being mindful to the potential and the capacities at hand of one's soul. Now, this idea of mura'at, of course, is very important because sometimes we see that we go to a lecture or we attend a speech, for example, the holy month of Ramadan,